New space science and the political push for Europa Clipper. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. The next crew of the International Space Station is set to perform over 200 experiments. But how do science experiments like those make it up to space in the first place? One way is with the International Space Station National Lab. It was created for scientists to have an opportunity to send their proposals to the orbiting lab. We'll speak with the National Lab's Ryan Reeves about how people can send their work into space, then a look at the political and public push to get NASA's Europa Clipper mission off the ground. After budget cuts and restrictions, the mission to explore Jupiter's icy moon for signs of life was pushed back for years. We'll speak with the Planetary Society's Casey Dreyer about the long history of NASA's mission to search the strange, watery world of Europa. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? When it comes to science on the space station, there's a lot going on up there, including more than 200 new investigations. A new crew of two launched to the International Space Station on SpaceX's Crew Dragon capsule. Those astronauts, along with the ones already on the station, have their hands full, thanks to the International Space Station National Lab. The organization was founded to provide an opportunity for researchers to send their science into space with the intention of benefiting humanity here on Earth. Here to talk more about that science and how you might be able to get your experiment into orbit is Ryan Reeves, the Technical Director of Research and Innovation at ISS National Lab. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me. It's an honor to be here. And, you know, we love talking about all the things happening up on the International Space Station.
We do, too. So I'm glad to have you here. And there's a lot happening up there. 200 experiments for this next operational crew. A lot of work being done. But before we get to the experiments, let's talk about the process of how an experiment gets to space. These are not all NASA missions, right? These are experiments coming from people all across the globe. How would somebody get an experiment into space?
Yes. So the ISS National Lab was created to open up opportunities to conduct research and development on the International Space Station for researchers across America, from the academic sector, from companies, anywhere that we're able to take advantage of the unique environment aboard the ISS, whether that be the microgravity environment, whether that be the vantage point that you have being 250 miles above the surface of the Earth, or the space environment, you know, if you're trying to prove out technologies. So we have open solicitations. If you go to issnationallab.org, we have running solicitations in everything from STEM education to technology development, fundamental science. There's a we try to offer a wide range of opportunities in many different technology areas.
I have to imagine, Ryan, it's quite competitive, these solicitations. What do you look for? It couldn't be me, a budding scientist, saying, I want to send something into space and see what happens. What are kind of the things that you've got to put in that solicitation to get selected? And further, you know, what are you looking for in a science experiment to send it to space?
Yeah, we have gotten a couple people wanting to send their cats. Those typically don't do very well. However, you know, what we're really looking for is, can it be done terrestrially? And if so, then it's probably not the right fit for you. What we want is we want to take advantage of the opportunity up there for research that can't be done anywhere else. So we're looking to see, is the use of the ISS justified? Are you trying to take advantage of one of those three areas, the microgravity environment, the space environment, or the vantage point? Are you looking to push technology areas forward? You know, are you either looking to advance your own technology or look at new discoveries? And is it going to have an impact for life here on Earth? That's one of the main drivers that kind of differentiates a lot of the experiments that we sponsor as opposed to the ones that NASA solely sponsors. Everything that we do has to benefit life here on Earth, whereas NASA has that mission, but they also have, you know, grander ideas of kind of exploration, the moon to Mars missions, things of that nature.
So you're telling me, if I want to send my cat to space, I need to go talk to NASA since I have no chance with you.
Don't tell them I sent you because, you know, I'm not sure if they want to, your cat either, but maybe.
These experiments are carried out by the crew on the International Space Station. And Crew 9 launched last month with two empty seats. They were saved to return Starliner astronauts Butch Wilmore Gilmore and Sonny Williams back to Earth when that crew returns. Does that kind of change how you plan for science at the space station? Do you have to look at the crew that is on board that's going to be conducting these experiments?
Yeah. So one of, you know, that's been one of the kind of blessings of all of the all the aspects of the Boeing Starliner mission. While that was successful in getting to the ISS and then returning, Butch and Sunny being still up there means that they're up and able to conduct all the experiments that we have. And we have quite a backlog of experiments ready to go. So, you know, all of that is taken into account. The amount of crew time that's up there and having them up there means that now we're able to conduct, you know, a few more experiments. So we're really grateful for them.
And they're both seasoned astronauts who have been up there before and have done experiments on the space station, right? That's going to be helpful too. They've got the experience. Let's chat a bit about Crew 9 is now up there, but they are awaiting a cargo mission, CRS-31. What's on board that cargo capsule that's particularly exciting for you and your organization that Crew 9 will be working on?
Yeah, so we have a number of investigations going up there. A number of them have been co-sponsored with us and funded by the National Science Foundation. We've had a long-running program with them going back 9 years or so in tissue engineering, as well as in transport phenomena, so fluid physics, heat transport, things of that nature. One that's that I'll point out is from Oregon State and Texas Tech. They're looking to study heart muscle atrophy, or the loss of some of the mass. If you think about kind of having a more sedentary lifestyle, or say being up in the microgravity environment where your heart doesn't have to work as much, you'll kind of lose mass over time. And so that's a major contributor to heart disease. So being able to study that in a weightless environment where you're not, you know, working out the heart as much gives us a lot of insight into how heart diseases progress and how we can potentially treat those here on Earth. We have a number of other investigations. So one of the things that we've been sponsoring quite a bit as of late has been, what can we produce uniquely in space? You know, certain products that we can only get in space. So one of those is Redwire. They have offices in Jacksonville, as well as other places. They're working with a large pharmaceutical company to crystallize new drug formulations, to potentially get new crystal formulations, new crystal structures for treating, for better treating diseases. And another one, another project that's going up that's also looking to treat various diseases is Saatchi Bio. They are testing a new therapeutic for diseases like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and dementia. So those are a number of different experiments that are up there. We have also some technology development demonstrations. For example, one is looking at how can we do remote operation of welding in space. So they're going to be doing some heatless welding, some cold welding that potentially could be used for repairing space stations sometime in the future.
Ryan, when you talk about some of those pharmaceutical things, new crystallizations, new drug formulas for Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, that really gets at the benefit to down here on Earth, right? Why is it such a unique environment to be having this kind of research in space? What is it about microgravity that is propelling these pharmaceutical discoveries forward by being in space?
One of the things we're better able to crystallize some things that wouldn't ordinarily crystallize here on Earth, whether that's because we have convection or, you know, the natural force of, you know, of molecules moving around because they're being heated, much like you have, you know, a boiling pot of water. You can think that's very a very dynamic situation. In microgravity, you don't have that convection. So now things are able to crystallize in ways that ordinarily a lot of that turbid solution, you know, would kind of break up. Researchers have been able to get larger crystals in space. They've been able to crystallize some proteins that haven't been able to. And what that's been able to allow them to do is, once we're able to crystallize certain proteins, now we can better characterize them. So we can then develop new drugs that can target the various aspects of it, neutralize those, and then better treat diseases.
Ryan, these experiments, they sound really interesting. They sound also very complex, especially cold welding, crystallizations of these pharmaceuticals. What is the actual medium of these experiments? Do you just send up supplies to the astronauts and they have a lab up there, or are these self-contained pieces of hardware that the astronauts work on?
Almost all of these are very well contained within their own hardware. And these are all developed by a series of partners. We call them commercial service providers. These are companies that have expertise in translating ground-based research into what can be done on station. So a lot of times they've developed their own hardware that is able to take in all of these, and then it's launched to the space station. And a lot of times a lot of this is now automated so that the crew is only having to load in new cartridges, take those out, put them in a freezer, things of that nature. Other experiments might be a little bit more hands-on. Sometimes the life science experiments or cellular research can be a little bit more hands-on, but a lot of it can be very well automated, such that we're really able to optimize how much crew time we're allotted.
And finally, Ryan, one of the types of experiments that you're sending up is a student-run experiment. Tell me a bit about that, and you know, why is it so important to involve young people in this scientific process on the International Space Station? It's got to be an incredible opportunity for them.
It is, and to hear the students talk through things, it blows your mind. There have been multiple times where I'm in the audience. I have a PhD, and so I've gone pretty far in my education. But you listen to some of the things that they're talking about, and you're just blown away that a high schooler is starting to get into this research that, honestly, until I started at the ISS National Lab, I hadn't even heard of before, right? So they're really doing some cutting edge research. One of the ones that just went up on Crew 9 just recently. This is a high schooler who is now graduated and is a freshman at Yale. She's working on radiation and how that affects cells. And is there a genetic component to that, so that potentially, we can learn from that and better shield our future astronauts in treating radiation and making sure that they're safe, which will be really important as the crew goes beyond the protections of low Earth orbit and goes to the moon and goes to Mars and beyond in the future.
Far more significant science than sending my cat to space. So I'm glad you chose that over my proposal. So Ryan Reeves is the Technical Director of Research and Innovation at ISS National Lab. Ryan, thank you so much for filling us in on what's up there right now.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And if anyone out there is interested in potentially sending your research to space, ISSnationallab.org, you'll be able to find our solicitations, as well as all the great research that we have been supporting.
Still to come, a glimpse into the heavy political lift to get NASA's Europa Clipper off the ground.
There's a fundamental mismatch between the timelines of planetary exploration and congressional elections. Very dramatically
and
different.
And presidential administrations.
And presidential administrations. So that's where I think having this broad public support really helps.
That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. NASA's Europa Clipper launched on SpaceX's Falcon Heavy rocket this week, beginning an ambitious mission to one of Jupiter's icy moons. The mission is designed to find out if the vast and strange ocean world of the moon Europa could support life, and to get us one step closer to understanding if we are indeed alone in the universe. The mission has enormous implications for the understanding of life in the solar system and beyond, but it almost never left the ground. Here to talk about the political science of funding and the public push to get this mission off the ground is the Planetary Society's Casey Dreyer. Casey, welcome back to the show.
Happy to be here. It's been a while.
It has been a while, but we're here for very exciting news because Europa Clipper is off the ground. But before we get into the long journey to this particular moment of that mission launching, just can you tell me why this is such an exciting mission for the planetary science community?
We're going to an ocean world for the first time, specifically to study an ocean world. You know, it's not a life detection mission, as NASA will keep saying, but come on, it is maybe one of the best, if not the best location in the solar system for a second genesis of life. And again, even if there's nothing there that they find, it's a strange, weird, wonderful place that I can't wait to see in high resolution.
When will we see that?
2030, 2031. My boss likes to say there's a lot of space in space. And so it takes a few years to get out there.
I mean, it's such a fascinating mission, but it almost didn't leave the ground. I mean, can you tell me about this years-long struggle to get Europa Clipper on this mission?
Yeah, I mean, it's wild. And I think it's so important to remember that these types of missions don't just happen. It's a great idea. It's an exciting idea, but that's not enough to spend, I think, roughly $5 billion at the end of the day and years of people's lives designing, building, flying, and then analyzing the data. You have to convince, in this case, a NASA, a public institution and a democracy, has to be convinced that it's worth spending the money. And that doesn't always happen in a empty sphere of what is the best science. It has to be balanced out within a broader set of political interests and programmatic interests at NASA. And it sometimes can take a while. And it was a long road. I mean, it was Voyager 2 that flew by Europa for the first time in 1979. That took some of the first pictures saying, hey, there's something strange going on here. It's a very young surface. It's cracked in weird ways. It probably is made of ice. It took another mission, Galileo, which had its own near-death experience, actually, in the early 1980s, was nearly canceled and nearly took JPL down with it. That was flying around Jupiter in the 1990s and did a number of flybys of Europa and measured an induced magnetic field, which suggested, hey, there could be a global ocean. And so it was really from the 1999 onwards that Europa itself became a priority for directed exploration. The scientific community has a number of formal ways to provide NASA input and for what's called decadal surveys. And so two subsequent big reports from the National Academies of Sciences highlighted Europa specifically as this is a mission worthy of going to. This should be the top large mission priority that you send that's not Mars related. And that just wasn't enough because NASA does other things. So the first recommendation came in 2003. And the following decade was NASA pivoting to Constellation, trying to send humans back to the moon, trying to finish the space station, spinning up an amazing robotic Mars program, and also, you know, invading Iraq, having a massive economic collapse and recession. And then when it was recommended again in 2011, we're still crawling out of the recession. NASA had lost a bunch of money, and it had just had big overruns in the Curiosity rover and James Webb Space Telescope. And the administration at the time just was not interested in pursuing this mission and had to be convinced otherwise through years of effort by the Planetary Society and many, many others. And I want to emphasize that many others within NASA, within Congress, and within the professional scientific community. This was a lot of people working many years to convince the coffers to open up.
And even outside of that group, Planetary Society members, right? I mean, I'm reading 384,000 messages were sent between 2013 and 2016 to representative in Congress and the White House to support Europa Clipper. I mean, this goes far beyond just the typical NASA and planetary science community. There was a big public push for this, was there not?
There absolutely was. And thank you for highlighting it. That's what made this, I think, profoundly unique and at the time so frustrating because we have a process to highlight scientific priorities. And not every science mission that's really important has to be publicly exciting, right? That's not an expectation we should have. But when they do align, when the public does innately become excited about something as profound as discovering life or understanding an ocean world, that should maybe weigh something, right? It is a publicly funded institution. And the Planetary Society, just to reemphasize, you know, we're a nonprofit, but we're member supported. And the vast majority of our members are just regular folks, i.e. not space industry people. The vast majority are just regular people who love space. That was the predicate of this organization, that people care about robotic space exploration and scientific space exploration enough to throw us a few bucks and enable this organization to exist. And Europa was one of those missions where we did not have to argue with our, you know, we didn't have to convince any of our members to support this. The idea sold itself. The reaction from our members and non-members, we facilitated anyone who wanted to write Congress. We provided means for them to do so. The response was just enormous. And we had people fly to Washington, D.C. and do congressional visits to talk about Europa and planetary exploration. Again, we sent, as you said, nearly 400,000 messages to the Congress and White House over those years. And I step back and you think about this, you know, that was in 2013, 14, 15, 10 years ago. The mission just launched and it'll get to Jupiter in 5.5 years. So all of these people who had nothing financial to gain, no invested professional benefits are coming their way because of this. All of those people took that time, that effort, the ones particularly who flew out on their own dime to Washington, D.C. to talk about this. So at best, they would see beautiful pictures coming back from this ocean world 20 years down the line.
Is that not a challenge in itself? And I know the answer to this question, Casey, because we've talked about this before. That is a challenge to these space missions. Your CEO says there's a lot of space in space. It takes a lot of time for these missions to get through. But it also needs the support of people in Congress and even, you know, presidential administrations that do not last as long as these missions do. How do you get something off the ground when the person who's going to be pushing for it may not be in office to take the credit for it?
There's a fundamental mismatch between the timelines of planetary exploration and congressional elections. Very dramatically different.
And presidential administrations.
And presidential administrations. Right. So that's where I think having this broad public support really helps. And also paired with kind of a fundamental and structured formal reporting process from the scientific community, where a new administration comes in and they can say, should we go out of our way to end these missions or that are in development or not do them or cancel or redirect the money elsewhere? Sometimes they do that. But if they look at this and say there's a really strong scientific component, clearly there's a big public support, and that public support, and this is the key, is represented through their elected officials. So you have numerous people in Congress willing to protect projects already happening. We talk a lot about John Culberson, who probably, and I think correctly, deserves more credit than any other politician for supporting Europa Clipper, but he lost his reelection bid in 2018. The mission was built over the next 6 years after that. And it happened because other people in Congress, and there was other people invested in the structure, in the system, that wanted to see this mission move forward. So he was instrumental getting it started. And then we had a broad base of political support. And that's, I think, where this public investment comes in, that it was Adam Schiff, a Democrat, Judy Chu, a Democrat, Lamar Smith, a Republican, you know, various other places and individuals invested in this who would support it. And I think a good way to compare it is Culberson was very excited to do a Europa lander on top of a Europa orbiter mission or Europa Clipper mission. That wasn't in the scientific consensus in the same way. And he was pretty alone on that funding it. And when he lost his reelection, the money for that went away. And so he didn't have that same buy-in.
What was the final price tag that Europa Clipper got?
The Europa Clipper is projected to cost $5.2 billion. At this point, we've actually spent about 4.2. So it's about 4.2 to build it. And then it's another $1 billion to run it for, I think, at least 10 years. Likely it will extend. Hopefully it will extend beyond that. It makes it actually, I think, the third most expensive planetary science mission NASA has ever launched.
Casey, do you fear that these missions are few and far between when it comes to the future? You talked about how difficult it was to get Europa Clipper out in the early 2000s and 2010s because of the recession. I know the economy is on top of mind, surely because it's an election year, but the economy still continues to weigh on people and their decisions when it comes to electing these politicians that appropriate these dollars. Is there a concern that it's going to be harder and harder to get these big dollar missions in the future?
Oh, absolutely. We're in a cyclical period right now. It feels very familiar to 10 years ago when we were trying to get Europa, particularly for planetary exploration at NASA, where we're struggling to move Mars sample return forward. That effort has stymied. There is a mission recommended to explore Uranus, a big orbiter mission that would be fantastic, that has no feasible way to get in the budget, at least as projected right now. Budgets are very difficult for all of those right now. And even the smaller missions, you know, like going to Venus, those are really struggling to get started. Absolutely, it's a problem right now. And we're in a situation where, just like in 2012 and 2013, we have a divided Congress, and it has forced pretty stringent spending caps and spending cuts that's really impacting NASA. I mean, this growth in planetary science that we saw that enabled Europa Clipper, that money was all additive. And it was occurring as NASA itself was growing and as overall federal spending was growing. And NASA generally goes as the direction of discretionary spending in the United States. So if Congress spends more, NASA tends to get more. If Congress spends less, NASA tends to get less. It's very unusual for the space agency writ large to buck that trend. And that then makes it, if it's going down, it makes it harder to then, you're pitting various sciences or other disciplines within NASA against each other. And you have what we're seeing now, a retrenchment and tension forming within the space agency about what its priorities are. And obviously where Artemis is happening, which is itself a set of issues and challenges for the space program to move forward. What we want to see ultimately is, can we do missions like Europa Clipper, I think, demonstrate you can turn this around. That's the lesson here. And you have to be ready to move when the opportunity presents itself. Another lesson I think that is really important from Europa Clipper is that you need an executable plan. Europa Clipper represents a completely reformulated idea of how to explore Europa. Instead of orbiting the moon directly, which is puts you just always in that really intense radiation environment from Jupiter that would kill a spacecraft. I think I heard one of the scientists say it's like the equivalent of a million chest x-rays every time Europa Clipper dips into that radiation environment. NASA reformulated this to fly by and dip in and out, and that saved the mission. And so Mars Sample Return, these other missions, they have to have executable, successful plans before the public can really step up and support them. Otherwise, it's a very difficult proposition.
But there is optimism. And Europa Clipper demonstrates that.
The launch and the fact that the mission is working and we're going to this incredible place. I've been revisiting a lot of my congressional letters and efforts and stuff and writing about this. And man, it was really tough at the time. So just to appreciate that this did change, that the system worked. And it doesn't change quickly. It doesn't happen fast. But sustained political pressure that has aligned support from scientific community and a path to success, that can work. And that can get us to these amazing things. And who knows what we're going to find at Europa. But when those images come down of this incredible surface, this alien world, this ocean world presenting itself to humanity for the first time, that should give us all this type of optimism. It's like, wow, what else can we do?
Casey Dreyer is the Chief of Space Policy at the Planetary Society. Casey, thanks for that.
Anytime.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or really wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with the show. Be sure to follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook. We're at AWTY Space. If you got an idea for a future episode of the show, or you want to join us as a guest, reach out. Our email is arewetheryet@cfpublic.org. More space coverage is online at cfpublic.org/space. Are We There Yet is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Our intern is Jenna Weiss. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.